Flashman and the Angel of the Lord by George MacDonald Fraser continued. Cassette 2, Side 2.
"Now you know what a crimped sailor man feels like," says he. "Yes, the schnapps is loaded, just like the mixture that fat tart slipped to me in Orleans. I believe in eye for eye, you see. No more, no less. You shipped me out drugged and helpless, and now you're going the same way. You can live on skilly and hardtack. You can try your VC and KB on a bucko mate. You can have your ass kicked from here to Baltimore and see how you like it, damn your blood!" His voice was rising again, but he checked himself and leaned forward to thumb up my eyelid, and I couldn't raise a hand to stop him. "That's right," says he. "Baltimore with the skipper of my acquaintance. If I were a vindictive man, it would have been Orleans, but I'm giving you an even chance, do you see? Baltimore's about right, I reckon. You've been there before, so you know what's waiting for you. Hey!" He stood up, and I tried to follow him. My legs wouldn't answer. I heaved and couldn't move a muscle. But the horror of it was that I could see and hear and feel the sweat pouring over my skin. God knows what poison he'd fed me, but it had gripped me all in an instant. I tried to speak, but only a croak came out. Spring laughed aloud and stooped to me, the demonic pale eyes gleaming, and began to shout at me. "Hear this, damn you, you'll go ashore derelict and penniless, as I did, and word will go ahead of you to the police and the federal people, not only in Baltimore, but in Washington and Orleans. You'll find they have fine long memories, Flashman. They'll remember Beecham, Millward, Comer. The U.S. Navy have their file on him, I dare say. Perjury, impersonation, and slave trading. Well, that's nothing, is it? You're wanted for slave stealing, too, as I recall, which is a capital offense, and they're a damn sight hotter on it now than they were 10 years ago, even. And then there's a small matter of complicity in the murder of one Peter Omohundro. Oh, it's quite a score. And I don't doubt there's more that I don't know about." He stood straight, and now he seemed to have swollen into a ghastly giant, white-bearded and hideous, who struck at me. But I couldn't feel the slaps, although they were jarring my head right and left. "See how much good your medals and honors and the brave name of Sir Harry Flashman does you, when the Yankee law has you by the neck. Aye, olim meminisse juvabit, rot you." His bellowings were growing fainter. "Crawl or run or worm your way out of that, if you can. Good luck to you. Bon voyage, you son of a bitch." The pounding in my ears blotted out all other sounds, and my sight was going, for I could no longer make out his form, and the cabin lights were dwindling to pinpoints. The nausea had passed, my senses were going, but I remember clear as day my last thought before I went under, and talking about Spring or Miranda or the hellish pickle awaiting me. No, for once I'd recognized his quotation. It had been framed on the wall of the hospital at Rugby, where I'd sobered up on that distant day when Arnold kicked me out. "Olim meminisse juvabit." And deuced appropriate, too. Seneca, if my memory serves. "It will be pleasant to remember former troubles." Virgil, not Seneca. 3 times in my life I've been shanghaied, and each time there was a woman in the case. Miranda Spring, Phoebe Carpenter, and Fanny Dubley. Although I acquit pretty little Fan of any ill intent, and the occasion in which she was concerned saw me trepanned with my eyes open. On the 2 others it was flashy, outward bound, with a belly full of puggle, from which I didn't awake until we were out to sea, and there's no worse place to come to than below deck on a windjammer when the skipper's in a hurry. This one was an American with a broken nose and a beard, like a scarf beneath his rock of a chin. My heart sank at the sight of him, for he had "Down Easter" written all over him. I'd hoped, when I crawled out of the stuffy hole in which I found myself and puked my heart out on a deck that seemed to be near perpendicular, that I'd find a good corruptible frog or dago on the poop. But Spring had chosen his man well, damn him. This one had eyes like flint and wine through his nose. "Spew over the side, can't you?" was his greeting as I staggered up out of the scuppers and held on for my life. He stood braced without support in a gale that was bringing green sea over the rail in icy showers, soaking me in an instant, but at least it washed my tiffin and supper away. "Do that in a calm and you'll swab it up yourself, mister. Now get back below till you can stand straight and keep out of the way, d'ye hear?" It's not easy to conduct negotiations on a spray-lashed deck during a howling tempest, but I was wasting no time. £100 if you'll take me to Port Nolloth or Walfish Bay. I'd no notion where we were in the South Atlantic, but I doubted if we were far out as yet. And any port would do as long as it wasn't Baltimore, or the Cape, with spring infesting the place. £500 if you'll carry me to England. "Got it on ye," shouts he. I hadn't. I'd been stripped clean of cash, papers, even my cheroot case. "You'll have it the moment we drop anchor. Look, £1,000 if you set me down anywhere between Brest and London. You don't have to be English waters even." That was when he knocked me down, grabbed me by the belt and heaved me aft. I'm over 13 stone, but I might have been his gunny sack. He threw me into his cabin, kicked the door to and watched me crawl to my feet. "That's the short way of telling you I ain't for sale," says he. "Least of all to a lousy, limey slave-stealer." Even in my distempered state, that sounded damned odd. "You ain't a Southerner, you're a Yankee, damn it." "That I am," says he, "and I make my living between Benin and Brazil, mostly. That satisfy you?" A slaver, in other words, if not this voyage. Trust spring. So I tried another tack. "You'll hang for this, do you know that? You're a kidnapper, and I'm Sir Harry Flashman, colonel in the British Army, and..." "Spring told me that's what you'd say, but you're a liar, and he ain't. Your name's Comer, and in the States they've got warrants out for you for everything except pissing in the street. Spring told me that, too, so any hanging there is, you'll do it." "You're wrong, you fool. I'm telling the truth, you Yankee idiot. Don't hit me." He stood over me, rubbing his knuckles. "Now you listen, mister, because I'm running out of patience. John C. Spring is my friend, and when he pays and trusts me for a job, I'll do it. And you're going to Baltimore, and we'll lay off Sparrow's Point a couple of days while the letters he gives me goes ashore, to let the traps know you're coming. And then you go. And till then, you'll work your passage. And I don't give 2 cents whether a port man seahorse's droppings if you're Comer or Lord Harry Flasher or President Buchanan, savvy? Now you get up and walk along easy to the forecastle, it's that way, and give your calling card to Mr. Fitzgibbon, who's a mate, and he'll show you to your stateroom. Now scat!" Having felt his fist twice, I scattered, and so began several weeks of vile hard work and viler food. But if you've been a slave to the Malagasies, or lain in a bottle dungeon in India, or been toasted on a gridiron, or fagged for Bully Dawson, well, you know, things could be worse. I'd been a deckhand before, but I didn't let on, so I was never sent aloft. Fitzgibbon and the skipper, whose name was Lynch, were first-rate seamen, so far as I'm a judge, and the last thing they wanted was some handless farmer hindering work, so I was tailing on and hauling and holy-stoning and greasing and painting and tarring and doing any of the countless unskilled menial tasks of shipboard. Oh, I cleaned the heads, too, and because I knew better than to shirk, I rubbed along well enough, bar seasickness, which wore off after a week, and inedible tack, and being played out with fatigue, and driven half crazy by that hellish creaking and groaning din that never ceases on a sailing packet. You get used to that, too, though. The forecastle gang were a hard-bitten crowd, Scowegians and Germans, mostly. But I was big and strong enough to be let alone, and I didn't encourage conversation. You may think I make light of it, being kidnapped and pressed into sea slavery, but if I've learned anything, it's that when you have no choice, you must just buckle down to misfortune. And wait. It was all sufficiently beastly, to be sure, but, you know, I reckon Spring was cheated of that part of his vengeance. As I've said, I've been through hell and back before in my checkered life, far worse than Spring had. And being a packet rat was that much less of an ordeal to me than it must have been to him. He thought he was God Almighty, you see, lording it over riffraff by virtue of his eminence, as he'd called it. By which I guess he meant his master's ticket and his M.A., and simply being the great John Charity Spring, classical don and fellow of Oriel, damn your eyes. Now, I am riffraff when I have to be, and so long as I can see a glimmer at the end of the passage, well, dum spiro spero. While I breathe, I hope, as we scholars say. Having his high table ass kicked must have had Spring gnawing the rigging. I took care not to be kicked. His haughty spirit rebelled. I ain't got one. Another thing that cheered me up was my belief that Spring, being mad as a weaver to start with, had let his harboured spite get the better of his few remaining wits. If he thought he was dooming me to death or the chain gang by packing me off to the States, he was well out of reckoning. What he'd said about my American embarrassments was true enough, but that had been a long time ago. It's a painful story, but in case you haven't read it in my earlier memoirs, I'll give you the heads of it here. 10 years back, when Spring Slaver, the Balliol College, with Flashy aboard as reluctant supercargo, had been captured off Cuba by an American patrol, I deemed it prudent to assume the identity of Beecham Millward Comer. Don't laugh, it was his name. Our late third mate, who told me on his deathbed that he was an Admiralty agent who was only sailing with Spring to spy on his slaving activities. If you think I'm stretching, the US Navy didn't. Comer's papers saw me through, but it was touch and go, so I'd slipped my cable and looked for a way home. I thought I'd found one when the Underground Railroad, a clandestine troop of lunatics who ran escaped slaves to Canada, got their hands on me. They had ears everywhere, even in the US Navy Department, and offered to help me north if I'd take an important runaway nigger with me to freedom. That enterprise had ended with me going over one rail of a Mississippi steamboat, while a darky with a slave catcher's bullet in him had gone over t'other. Subsequently, I'd been overseer on a plantation, lost my situation for rogering the lady of the house, escaped north with a female octoroon slave who'd killed two men en route, been shot on the backside by pursuers while crossing the Ohio River, found refuge with Congressman Abraham Lincoln, who dragooned me into testifying at the adjudication on Spring's slave ship in New Orleans, been unwillingly reunited with my dear old commander, who had then murdered one Omo Hundro in a pub, fled with him to seek shelter with a whore of my acquaintance, who'd obligingly had old J.C. Shanghai'd, and had at last won back to England, home and beauty via the Great Plains, an Apache village, and San Francisco. Slightly out of breath. Honestly, I'd have been better going into the church, or banking, or politics even. In any event, that's how the sparks flew upward on my first visit to America, and you can see Spring's point. In my brief sojourn, I'd been an impostor and perjurer, as Comer, stolen slaves, under the names of Prescott, Arnold, and I rather think Fitzroy Howard, or something like that, and was wanted for murders I hadn't committed in Mississippi, or it may have been Tennessee, for all I know, as well as for aiding and abetting, which I hadn't done either, Spring's stabbing of Omo Hundro. An impressive tally, I concede, and none the better for being all entirely against my will. However, I doubted if the US Navy was much concerned with the fugitive Comer at this late date, and I had no intention of going near the Mississippi. I wasn't wanted in Maryland, where Baltimore is. Let me present myself to a British consul there, or in Washington, which was only 40 miles away, and I was on Easy Street. Great thing, you see, was that I wasn't Comer, or Prescott, or those other chaps, but I was Sir Harry Flashman, not unknown by name and fame. And once I was under our embassy's wing, warrants from far-flung states for the arrest of non-existent Comers, etc., would matter not at all. Not in Washington, or the North at least. If I were fool enough to venture south, where there might be witnesses to identify me, that would be a different and damned unpleasant kettle of fish. As Spring had pointed out, my rank and heroic stature at home wouldn't weigh much with a Louisiana jury. So, you can see why I wasn't over-troubled about what lay ahead. Indeed, my preoccupation was how to pay Spring out when I was safe home in England. The evil-eyed bastard had terrified, drugged, and kidnapped me, subjected me to the grueling misery of packet ratting, and done his damnedest to deliver me to an American gallows. Well, he was going to rue the day. Straight prosecution was out of the question, and it'd take too long. Likely uncover past history, which I'd rather keep dark, and almost certainly fail in the end. The whole business was too wild, and the thought of returning to testify at the Cape, with Spring frothing at me across the court. Oh, no, I'd prefer not. Especially since the most artistic revenge had already occurred to me. A detailed account to the address of J.C. Spring, M.A., of the contortions which his saintly Miranda and I had performed aboard dear Papa's yacht. That would bring a blush to his cheek. It would destroy him, wound him to the depths of his rotten soul, probably drive him crazy altogether. He might even murder her and swing for it. Well, the bitch deserved it. No, she'd swear blind that I was lying out of spite, and he'd believe her, or pretend to, but in his heart he'd always know it was the truth. Aye, that would teach him that flesh is a critter best left alone, because, as Thomas Hughes pointed out, he can find ways of striking home that you ain't even thought of. Now, I'll not weary you with any further relation of life at sea when Uncle Harry was a lad, but hasten on to Chesapeake Bay, which I reckon we reached in about 8 weeks, but it may have been more. I made 2 further attempts to suborn Captain Lynch, promising him Golconda if he would put me down at New York or Boston. But I might as well have talked to the mast. I believe my speech and bearing and my conduct aboard had sown some doubt in his mind, for he didn't hit me on either occasion. But perhaps because he was a man of his word, as some of these half-wit shellbacks are, or more likely because Spring had a hold on him, he wasn't to be budged. You're going to Baltimore even if the Chesapeake's afire, so you can save your wind, says he. And that was that. We lay 2 days in the bay, and I didn't doubt that Spring's letters had gone ashore with the pilot. Now that the grip had come, all my assurance had melted like snow off a dike. And I was in a fine funk again, dreaming hideous nightmares, in which I was swimming slowly towards a misty jetty on which stood Yankee peelers, brandishing warrants made out for the handsomest man in the army, and jangling their handcuffs. And all my American ill-willers were there singing jubilee. Omohundro and the squirt Mandeville had caught me galloping his wife, and Buck, the slave catcher, and his gang, and the poker-faced Navy man whose name I'd forgotten, and blasted George Randolph, the runaway nigger I'd abandoned. And vague figures I couldn't make out, but I knew they were the Comanches of Bent's Fort and Iron Eyes who chased me. And then somehow I was in the adjudication court at Orleans, but instead of the wizened little adjudicator, it was Spring on the bench in gown and mortarboard, waving a birch and shouting, "Aye, there he is, the great toad who ravishes daughters and can't construe Horace to save his soul. Flash manum monstrum informe ingens et horrendum." The monster flashman, shapeless, huge, and horrible, adapted from Virgil's description of Polyphemus. "Mark him well, ladies and harlots, for Juvenal never spoke a truer word. Omne in praecipiti vitium stetit. By thunder, every kind of vice has reached its summit." And when I looked at the jury, they were all the American women had betrayed or discarded. Fat Susie weeping, Sancierre sulking, the French nigger Cleone, whom I'd sold to the priest at Santa Fe, willowy Cassie looking down her fine nose, coal-black Aphrodite and the slave women at Greystone's. But their faces were all turned to the bench, and now it wasn't Spring who sat there, but Arnold, in a pilot cap, glowering at me. And then Miranda was tripping up beside him, swirling her hair about her like a cloak, giggling as she stooped to whisper in his ear. But it wasn't his ear. It was Congressman Lincoln's, and I saw his ugly face scowl as he listened, nodding, and heard his drawl as he said that reminded him of a story he'd heard once from an English naval officer who didn't know what club-hauling meant. I came back to waking very slowly, with sense stealing over me like a sunrise, almost imperceptibly, growing gradually conscious of a throbbing ache in my temples and a dryness in my mouth and throat that was truly painful. There was someone beside me, for I could feel the warmth of a body, and I thought, Elspeth, until I remembered that I was in a ship at sea bound for Baltimore, and that awful nightmare, which, thank God, was only a dream after all, conjured up out of my fears. But there was no motion about the place on which I lay, no gentle rocking, as there should have been as we lay at anchor in the Chesapeake. I opened eyelids that seemed to have been glued together, expected to see the knot-hole in the floor of the bunk above me, as I'd seen it with every awakening for the past many weeks. It wasn't there, and no bunk either. Instead, there was a dingy white ceiling, and when I turned my head, there was a bare wall with a grimy window. I was ashore then, but how? And for how long? I tried to conjure up my last memory of shipboard, but couldn't with the ache in my head. And to this day, I don't know how I left the ship, drunk, drugged, or sandbagged. At the time, it didn't signify anyway, and even as I reached that conclusion, a woman's voice said,
"Hello, dearie. Awake, are you? Say, didn't you have a skinful, though?"
An American cackle piercing my ear, and I shuddered away by instinct, which was sound judgment, for if I felt dreadful, she looked worse, a raddled slattern grinning her stinking breath into my face, reaching out a fat hand across my chest. I almost catted on the spot, one thought uppermost. Did I... We... It came out in a faint croak, and she leered and heaved herself half across me. The paint on her face looked about a week old, and her awful bulk was clothed only in a grubby shift.
"You mean, did you and me?"
She loosed another braying laugh, displaying bad teeth.
"No, dearie, we didn't. Yet. You've been snoring your big head off all night, but you're awake now. So, how about my present?"
"Get away from me, you pox-ridden slut!" Another hoarse whisper, but I had strength enough to thrust her away and tumbled over her to the floor. I scrambled up, dizzy, and almost fell again, staring about me at a big, unbelievably foul, whitewashed room, in which there were about a dozen beds containing various beings, male and female, in squalid undress. The stench of stale tobacco and unwashed humanity took me by the throat, and I blundered for the door, falling over a frantically courting couple on the floor, and followed by shrill obscenities from my bedmate. I found myself on a bare landing, confronting a goggling darkie with a bucket in his hand. "Where the hell am I?" I inquired, and had to repeat myself and take him by the collar before he stammered, rolling his eyes. "Why, boss, you into knitting swedes?" Only later did I know what he'd said. At the time it sounded like gibberish. "What town is this?"
Why, this Baltimore, boss. Yes, that is Baltimore, honest."
I let him go and stumble down two flights of stairs, with no notion but to get out of this beastly place without delay. There were other doors, some of them open onto sties like the one I'd left, and various creatures on the landings, but I didn't pause until I bore up unsteadily by a big wooden counter on the ground floor. And I think there was a tap room, too. But what matters was that there was a street door ahead of me, and open air. There were a number of seamen lounging at the counter, and behind it, sitting on a high stool, was a figure so unlikely that I thought, I'm still drunk or dreaming. He was big and ugly, with a nose that had been spread half across his face, probably by a club. There wasn't a hair on his phiz or gleaming skull. The huge arms protruding from his vest were covered with tattoos. But what took the eye was that he was clicking away with knitting needles at a piece of woolen work. Not a common sight in a waterfront doss house. He purled, or cast off, or whatever it is that knitters do when they want to take a breather, and nodded to a fellow in a striped shirt who was laying some coins on the counter. Then he looked at me, and I realized that the loungers were doing the same, in a most disconcerting way. I had got some sense back now and saw that this was plainly the receipt of custom, where guests settled their accounts and ordered up their carriages. Equally plainly, I'd spent the night on the premises, but when I put a hand to my pocket, the bald head shook emphatically.
"You paid for, Yanni," says the knitting Swede. "You want some grubius now?"
I declined with thanks, and he nodded again.
"You could ship me beep?"
I was about to say no, but one look at the loungers stopped me. Too many ferret eyes and ugly mugs for my liking, and I'd no wish to be crimped a second time. I said I had a ship, and a greasy disease in a billycock hat and brass watch chain asked, "What ship would that be, sailor?" the sea witch, and I'm Polly Waterman, so get the hell out of my way, says I. Being over 6 feet and heavy set has its uses, and I was out in the street and round the corner before he'd had time to offer me a drink and a billy behind the ear. You didn't linger in establishments like the Knitting Swedes, not unless you fancied a free holiday in a whaler for the next couple of years. I walked on quickly, reflecting that it had been considerable of Lynch to pay my lodging, but then it may have been a club rule that insensible members had to be settled for in advance. I walked for 2 minutes and felt so groggy that I had to sit down in a barrel at the mouth of an alley, where I took stock. I knew I was in Sailortown, Baltimore, but that was all. The growth on my chin told me I hadn't been ashore above 24 hours. Whatever information Spring had sent to the authorities must have been in their hands for 2 days by now, and no doubt it would contain an excellent description even down to my clothes. These consisted of a shirt and trousers, boots, and a canvas jacket, the crease not improved by a night in that verminous hole I'd just escaped from. I've since learned, by the way, that it was quite celebrated among the less discriminating seafarers. If you'd stopped at the Knitting Swedes, you could dine out on it in every shebeen from Glasgow to Sydney. Now, I doubted if the authorities would be scouring the streets for Beecher Millward Coma, but the sooner I was under the protection of my country's flag, the better. A port the size of Baltimore must surely have a British consul, or some kind of commercial representative at least, who shouldn't be too difficult to find. He might look askance at my appearance, but it would have to do, since Captain Lynch's generosity hadn't run the length of leaving a single damn penny, or anything else, in my pockets. It wouldn't make my bona fides any easier to establish, but I'd meet that trouble when I came to it. Although I'd been in Baltimore before, with the U.S. Navy folk, I'd no notion of how the town lay, so I took a slant along the street, which was bustling with business round the chandler's shops and warehouses, and approached a prosperous-looking old gent to inquire the way to the centre of town. I'd barely got a word out when he rounded on me. "You goddamn leeches, can't you work for a change?" cries he. "I declare you're stout enough." He slapped 10 cents into my hand and strode on, leaving me wondering if it would buy me a shave. And now that my head was clearing, I found I was almighty hungry. You know, within an hour I was richer by $4. And a splendid new vocabulary. First time I ever heard the word bum mean anything but backside was on that morning. The beauty of it was I didn't have to beg even. My dishevelled clothing, unshaven chin and most charming smile, with a courteous finger raised to the brow, marked me as a mendicant apparently, and for every 9 who brushed past, a 10th would drop a few coppers in my palm. Damned interesting, I found it. Women were altogether more generous than men, especially as I moved uptown, when I approached 2 fashionable young misses with, "Pardon me, ma'am," and a bow, one of them exclaimed, "Oh, my," and gave me 50 cents and a fluttery look before they hurried away, tittering. I left off, though, when I became aware that I was being watched by a belted constable with a damned disinheriting moustache. But I've calculated since that I could have cleared $10,000 a year on the streets of Baltimore. Easy, which is 2,000 quid, sufficient to buy you a lieutenancy in the guards in those days, and from the look of some of them I'd not be surprised. I was still no nearer finding the consul, and the constable had given me a scare, so after a shave and brush up and a hearty steak and eggs at a chop house, I looked for a fellow countryman, and the sure way to do that in America in those days was to find a Catholic church. I spotted one, noted that the name of its priest displayed on the gilt board was Rafferty, made my way through the musty, waxed image interior, and found the man himself delving like a navigator in the garden behind the church, whistling the young May Moon in his shirt sleeves. He greeted me with the cry of, "Hello, my son, and what can I be doing for you on this parky day?" A jaunty little leprechaun with a merry eye. I asked my question, and he pulled a face. "Faith, now, and I don't know there's any such creature in Baltimore," says he. "Just off the boat, are you?" The shrewd blue eyes took me in. "Well, if it is diplomatic assistance you're seeking, Washington will be the place for you, where our minister is. He's new come, and all, they tell me. Lyons, his name is, an English feller. He'll be your man right enough. And what would you say, yes or no, to a cup of tea?" Seeing him so affable and with only $2 in my pocket, it struck me that if I played smooth, I might touch him for the fare to Washington. So I affected the faintest of brogues and introduced myself as Grattan Nugent Hare, who was rotting safely in a cottonwood grove somewhere south of Socorro, of the Rathfarnham and Trinity College, lately arrived to join my brother Frank, who held a minor position in a Washington bank. Unfortunately, I'd been set upon soon after landing the previous night, and was without cash or effects. He opened eyes and mouth wide.
"Dear, tell me, dear God, what's the world coming to? And you with your foot barely on the ground, and from Dublin, too? Have you been to the policeman, dear? You have, and got little good of them? Aye, well, they've a hard row to hoe, with some queer ones in this town, I'll tell you. They wouldn't know of a British consul, neither. No, it's a wonder they didn't think to steer you to a fellow countryman, at least. There's enough of English and ourselves hereabouts, God knows. But they didn't. Ah, well. But come away and we'll have that dish of tea while we think what's best to be done. And how's the Liffey looking, eh?"
I sat in his kitchen while he prattled Irishly and made tea. Since I'd never been in Dublin in life, I found it safest to let him run on, with a cheery agreement from time to time, waiting an opportunity to state my needs, but he didn't give me one, being content to prose sentimentally about the old country until...
"And you're in the banking line yourself, are you?"
says he at last.
"Ah, well, you're in the right furrow in America. Fine grand opportunities for a gentleman like yourself, so there are. It's a commercial world, so it is. It's a commercial world. But none the worse for being that if the trade's honest and the word's good. And you're a Trinity man, too."
He chuckled wistfully.
"Ah, this is a country of grand prospects. But I wonder could a man do better than sit in the old college court contemplating the trees on St. Stephen's Green on a summer's evening? It'd be there about 45, am I right?"
I made a hasty calculation and said rather earlier, 43.
"Then you would know old Professor Palin,"
cries he.
"A fine man, that, and a grand Hebrew scholar, so they said. Not that I'm a judge. He would still be about in your day, was he not?"
I can smell a false lead as fast as anyone, but he was such a happy simpleton that I decided it was safe to say I hadn't studied under Palin myself, but knew of him. He nodded amiably and sighed.
"Ah, well, here am I blathering on and you itching to take you away to Washington. Aye, but with your pockets all to let. Well, man, dear, I was after thinking yonder that I'd be making you a small loan for your train ticket. But, you know, I'd be party to an awful sin if I did that, so I would. You see,"
says he, shaking his porky old head,
"the day you find a priest sitting in the court at Trinity is the day you'll be able to skate over Dublin Bay from Bray to Balbriggan. And as for seeing St. Stephen's Green from the court, well, I doubt if even old Phelan could see that far from heaven, where he's been this 35 years, God rest his soul. And telling me ye were a banker," he added sorrowfully, "and you with spurs and brass buttons sticking out all over you. Now, will you take another drop of tea, soldier, and tell me all about it?"
"You wouldn't believe it if I did," says I, rising. "Thank you for the tea, Padre, and I'll bid you a very good day."
Stop, cries he. "Sit down, man, dear, and don't be taking offence at an old man just because he knows Phoenix Park's shoulders when he sees them. Come now, be easy, and drink your tea. Can you not see I'm bursting to know the truth of it?"
His smile was so eager and friendly that I found myself smiling in turn. "What makes you think I'll tell truth this time?"
"Why shouldn't you? You'll come to no harm from me if you do, and if you don't, well, I might have no diversion at all. Now then, what's this I wouldn't believe? Just you try me."
"Very well. I'm a British Army officer. I was on my way home from India. I was waylaid at Cape Town and crimped aboard a packet which arrived here yesterday. I'm destitute, but thanks to you I know where to find British authorities who will help me back to England. And if you believe that..."
"And why would I not? It fits you better than all that moonshine about banking and Trinity. I'll say that for it. What's your name, my son?"
There was no earthly reason why I shouldn't tell him. So I shook my head. Least said.
"And why didn't you ask direction from the first policeman you saw?"
I still said nothing, and he nodded, no longer smiling. I rose again to go, for the sooner I was out of this, the better, but he stayed me with a hand on my sleeve.
"You'll tell me no more? Well, now just bide a minute while I think about..." "No, don't go. You want the fare to Washington, don't you?"
I waited while he cogitated, chin in hand, eyes bright as a bird's.
Tell you what I think. You're an officer, and a bit of a gentleman, I know the look. And you're a runner. No, no, don't be adding to your sins by denying it, for I had a parish in Leeks in the Great Trouble, and I know that look, too. Aye, twice as long in the leg as you would be if I put a foot rule on you. And, man, dear, you're a desperate liar. But who's not, will you tell me? But you're civil, at least, and your army. And didn't me own father and two uncles, and that other good Irishman, Arthur Wellesley, follow the flag across Spain together? They did.
He paused and sighed.
Now, you're a Protestant, so I can't penance you for telling lies. But since I'm dreadful afflicted with the rheumatics and can't abide digging at all, well, if you can sink your gentlemanly pride and finish them two rows for me, why, 'twill be for the good of your soul and my body. And there'll be $10 to take you to Washington, 9.5 in loan, to be repaid at your convenience, and 50 cents for your labour. Well, what say you, my son?
Well, I needed that $10, but who'd have thought, when Campbell pinned my cross on me, that 7 months later I'd be digging a bog-trotter's garden in Maryland? Father Rafferty watched me as I turned the last sods, observing dryly that it was plain to see I was English from the way I handled a spade. Then he gave me a mug of beer and counted $10 carefully into my palm.
"I'll walk you to the station," says he. "No one'll look twice at you when you're keeping step with the church. And I can see you don't get on the wrong train or lose your money, or go astray anyways, you know."
He put me on the right train, sure enough, but the rest of his statement proved as wrong as could be. Someone did look at us, but I didn't notice at the time, possibly because I was busy parrying Rafferty's artful questions about the army and India. At least I could satisfy him I was telling the truth about those.
"Ask at the Washington station where the British minister's to be found,"
he advised me.
"And if they don't know, make your way to Willard's Hotel on 14th Street, and they'll set you right. It's a great place, and if they turn up their noses at your togs, just give them your Hyde Park swagger, eh?" "But mind how you go now,"
cries he as I mounted the steps to the coach.
"'Twill be dark by the time you get in, and 'tis a desperate place for garrotters and scallywags and the like. We wouldn't want you waylaid a second time, would we?"
Gratitude ain't my long suit, as you know, but he'd seen me right, and he was a cheery wee soul, looking down at the smiling pixie face under the round hat. I couldn't help liking the little Murphy, and wondering why he'd been at such pains on my behalf. It's a priest's business, of course, to succour the distressed sinner, but I knew there was more in it than that. He was a lonely old man, far from home, and he was Irish, and had guessed I was on the run, and I was army, like his father and uncles, and he'd taken to me as folk do, even when they know I'm not straight.
"I wish you'd tell me your name, though,"
says he when I thanked him. I said I'd send him my card when I repaid the $10.
"That you will,"
cries he heartily.
"In the meantime, though, your Christian name, eh?"
"Harry."
"I believe you. You look like a Harry. God knows you didn't look like, what was it, Grattan? Grattan the bank from Rathfarnham? Heh, the impudence of it."
He laughed and looked wistful.
"Aye, me. Sometimes I could wish I'd been a rascal myself."
"It's never too late," says I, and he spluttered in delight.
"Get away with you, spalpeen,"
cries he, and stood waving as the train pulled out, a little black figure vanishing into the hissing steam. I reckon Father Rafferty was one of those good fools who are put into the world to grease the axles for people like me. They charm so easy, if you play 'em right, and the bigger a scoundrel you are, the more they'll put themselves out for you. No doubt in the hope that if you do reform, they'll get that much more treasure in heaven for it. You may be astonished to know that I did repay the loan later on, but in no spirit of gratitude or obligation, or because I'd quite liked the little ass. No, I paid because I could easily afford it. And there's one rule, as a practicing pagan, that I don't break if I can help it. Never offend the local tribal gods. It ain't lucky. It was dark when we pulled into Washington, and the conductor had never heard of the British ministry. Oh, sure, he knew Willard's Hotel, but plainly wondered what business this rumpled traveller without a hat could have at such a select establishment. He was starting to give me reluctant directions when a chap who'd alighted from the train directly behind me said if it was Willard's I wanted, why, he was going that way himself. He was a sober-looking young fellow, neatly dressed, so I thanked him and we went out of the crowded station into a dark and dirty Washington evening.
It's close enough to walk, if you don't mind the rain, says my companion, and since it seemed only prudent to save my cash, I agreed, and we set off. It wasn't too damp, but Washington didn't seem to improve much in 10 years. They were still building the place and making heavy weather of it, for the street we followed was ankle-deep in mud, and so poor was the lighting that you couldn't see where you were putting your feet. We jostled along the sidewalk, blundering into people, and presently my guide pulled up with a mild oath, and glanced about him and said we'd be quicker taking a side street. It didn't look much better than an alley, but he led the way confidently, so I ploughed on behind, thinking no evil, and suddenly he lengthened his stride, wheeled round to face me, and whistled sharply. I'm too old a hand to stand with my mouth open. I turned to flee for the main street, cursing myself for having been so easily duped, and after Rafferty's warning about footpads too, and stopped dead in my tracks. Two dark figures were blocking my way, and before I had time to turn again to rush on my single ambusher, the larger one stepped forward. But when he raised his hands, it wasn't to strike. He held them palms towards me in a restraining gesture, and his voice when he spoke was quiet, even friendly. Good evening, Mr. Comer. Welcome back, sir. Why, you mayn't believe it, but this is just like old times. For a split second, I was paralyzed in mind and body, and then came the icy stab of terror as I thought, police, Spring's letters, my description, the alarm going out for coma. But then why had the young man not clapped his hand on my shoulder at the station? Guess you don't remember me, says the big shadow. It's been a while. Norlands, 10 years ago, and back of Willink's place. You thought I was Navy then. I took you to Crixus, remember? It was so incredible that it took me a moment to recall who Crixus was, the underground railroad boss whose identity I never knew because he hid it under the name of some Roman slave who'd been a famous rebel. Crixus was the little steely-eyed bugger who dragooned me into running that uppity nigger Randolph up the river, and damn near got me shot. But it wasn't possible that he could know of my presence now, within a day of my landing. He's waiting to see you, says the big fellow. And the sooner we get you off the streets, the better. We've got a closed cab. I don't understand. You're quite mistaken, sir. I know of nobody called... Cricket, did you say? I was babbling with shock, and he absolutely laughed. Say, I wish I could think as quick as you do. 10 years ago, Billy, says he to his companion. When we jumped this fella, he started talking Dutch. Now come along, Mr. Comer, because I'd know you anywhere, and we're wasting time and safety. His voice hardened, and he took my arm. We mean you no harm. Like I once told you, you're the last man I'd want to hurt. Sometimes you feel you're living your life over again. It was so now. And for an uncanny moment, I was back in the alley behind Susie's brothel, with the three figures materializing out of the darkness. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.